From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll speak with the superintendent of Milwaukee County's Community Reintegration Center about her approach to rehabilitation.
The fact of the matter, especially those individuals at the CRC, they're going to return to the community. So it's a matter of how do you want individuals to return to your community? I would assume better and not creating more victims.
Then a local man who was incarcerated as a teenager shares what challenges he's faced since his release.
I began to say to myself, I got a life now. I was starting to feel, you know, like I was living and I had built something for myself. That was all I wanted, was that opportunity to make a life for myself.
Plus, we'll explore what makes dive bars a staple in Wisconsin culture. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. The Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center, formerly known as the House of Correction, is the state's largest county correctional institution. Located in Franklin, people incarcerated at the facility serve misdemeanor sentences and return to our communities after less than a year. In recent years, the center has focused more on offering vocational and health programming to people incarcerated there, getting families involved, and inviting audits of the facility from third-party observers. Chantel Jewell is the superintendent of the Community Reintegration Center, and she joins Lake Effect's Sam Woods to discuss the center's approach to rehabilitation.
I want to start with some core facts about the Community Reintegration Center in Franklin, formerly known as the House of Corrections. First, how many people are in your care, and what is the average length of stay?
So today we have approximately 1,215 individuals in our care at the CRC, and we call it the CRC for short. And the average length of stay for individuals that are sentenced to the CRC is 100 days.
Is there a typical backstory of people in your care?
Well, typically, individuals that are sentenced to the CRC are sentenced on misdemeanor cases, meaning low-level cases, and they are serving a year or less.
This is a bit of an open-ended question, but I'm curious to see how you think about it. What would you say is the goal of incarceration?
The goal of incarceration is to change behavior, address needs, the needs of whatever has brought an individual into contact with the carceral system. Overall, just in general, approximately 97% of individuals in a carceral setting, jail, prison, will return to the community. So it's important that we provide programming and opportunity that supports change, because that is how we will, in fact, create safer communities once individuals are released.
So you mentioned programs and opportunities. Can you expand on what those are at the CRC?
Right. So we try to make sure all of our programming is evidence-based practice or aligned with evidence-based practices. A long time ago, when I started in corrections way back in 1996, you know, when I was trained, I basically did what my mentor told me to do. But shortly thereafter, there became a body of evidence to tell us what works in corrections, what types of things reduce recidivism. And so we try to make sure our programming is aligned with that. So that includes educational opportunities, job training, skills training, cognitive behavioral therapy, substance use disorder treatment, and those type of programs is what we have to offer at the Community Reintegration Center.
So you mentioned education, jobs, mental health, substance abuse, help as things that work when it comes to rehabilitating or getting someone ready to reenter society. On the flip side, you mentioned you have a long career in corrections. What have you seen that doesn't work?
Sitting people in jail without offering them any type of programming. And the research, in fact, tells us incarceration without any treatment doesn't produce long-term change.
I can imagine that you run into people who see punishment and punishment alone as the goal of incarceration, that these people committed a crime, they need to be punished, and that's why they are in prison. Do you find yourself having to change minds and explain that your goals are a little more complicated than that?
Sure. I find myself having to educate people on what needs to happen while individuals are in custody. The fact of the matter, especially those individuals at the CRC, they're going to return to the community. So it's a matter of how do you want individuals to return to your community? I would assume better and not creating more victims. But then there are those who may have been a victim of a crime or experienced. A family member may have experienced some type of victimization and may feel like these people are in jail, so they don't deserve these opportunities. And for us, it's about, again, I'll say it over and over, it's about helping individuals produce long-term behavioral changes so that they don't get out and create more victims or continue being involved in criminal activity. And that is how we create safer communities.
Yeah. So last week, we aired an interview on Lake Effect that I did with Wisdom Wisconsin, and it was about their campaign to provide free video and phone calls to those incarcerated within Wisconsin. And the interview outlined how people incarcerated in Wisconsin foot the bill for staying connected to loved ones, often leaving them and their families in debt once they get out. Can you tell me about how you ensure that people in your care stay connected to loved ones while they're inside?
Sure. Under my tenure, we've done a number of things. One being that they do have free phone calls and free video visitation in Milwaukee County. We feel like it's important to keep people connected to their families. Under my leadership, we were also able to open up our visitation center. Hadn't been opened over a decade. Sheriff Clark shut it down. We've also hired a family outreach coordinator. His whole job, he is the liaison between the families and the residents in our care. So someone may call and say, I'm concerned about my son. I haven't heard from him in X amount of time. And that person will actually go do a wellness check or say, hey, call your mom. She's worried about you. And then another opportunity through a grant, we were able to open up a family visitation center. And so that was to serve our residents, the non-incarcerated parent, and the children, because the evidence tells us that family distress is a driver of recidivism. So we want to help to facilitate those broken familial bonds, because when someone becomes incarcerated, they're not the only people impacted. If they have a family, they're impacted as well. Then we have a Literacy Links program where parents are able to stay connected to their children through reading and promoting literacy, and they're able to go on a video visitation and read a book with their child or do homework help or send a recorded tape of them reading with the children. So like I said, we try to stick pretty close to the evidence, and so we know that family distress is one of those top drivers of recidivism.
Do you find that families are typically eager to take part in this process?
We do not have to persuade family members to stay connected to their loved ones. As a matter of fact, I wasn't sure when we opened visitation that people would take advantage of it, simply because now we have the video visits and you don't have to drive all the way to Franklin, but our visiting stays full. So people are eager to stay connected to their loved ones. And our family outreach specialist in 1 year had thousands of contacts.
Yeah. So I want to talk about transparency. So have you allowed third parties, and this can be community groups, this can be other government agencies, to inspect conditions at the CRC on a regular basis?
Yes. So we've done a number of things where we've voluntarily let people come in and audit the work that we're doing. One was the National Commission on Correctional Healthcare. That is the gold star of healthcare in any correctional facility. And we've been accredited twice under my leadership. We also have Prison Rape Elimination Act, where we get an audit from the Department of Justice, a Department of Justice auditor every 3 years. And then we also have an annual jail inspection through the state of Wisconsin. So, and we have an audit coming up from the American Correctional Association this year as well. And that is the highest achievement that a correctional facility can obtain.
And are the reports that these auditors produce publicly available, or is that something only you and prison officials get to see?
Some are publicly available and some available through open records.
So when I've done interviews or reporting on jails and prisons in the past, staffing is often an issue that is brought up, particularly when the story revolves around substandard conditions at a jail or prison. Before getting into how you have addressed staffing at the CRC, can you explain generally the connection between fully staffing prisons and better conditions for those who are incarcerated?
Sure. Staffing shortages result in a lot of overworked employees. And so sometimes when individuals are overworked, they may tend to make mistakes. It's never ideal to have people working 16-hour days.
Now back to the CRC. When it comes to boosting staffing, what have you seen that works? Is it just offering higher pay and that's it, or is it a little more complicated than that?
We have not quite figured out what works. We did boost the pay, and what that did for us was got us a greater pool of applicants. But once you get through the screening process, that doesn't necessarily translate into a lot of hires, although we have a lot of applicants. We are working on culture. Having been a correctional practitioner for 30-plus years, culture is very important, creating a culture of professionalism, a culture where people can grow and they can thrive in their careers. And so we're very fortunate at the CRC where there's a lot of opportunity for growth. You know, we have a number of supervisory positions that people can grow into. I just spoke to new recruits today before I came, encouraging them to treat the CRC or this opportunity as more than a job, but look at it as a career and create career pathways for individuals to grow in the industry.
Tell me more about culture, like how you think about culture at the CRC, both from the point of view of staff and from the point of view of people in your care.
So in terms of staff, I don't have an institutional background. I came from community corrections. And so when I got there, I noticed that my staff do a lot of things well in terms of security, but I wanted to help them to grow in other things. So we're bringing on things like crisis intervention, just equipping them with more tools to help them be more effective in their roles. And so that was something that I don't think staff were necessarily accustomed to, or elevating programming. So there's always been programming, but it's probably programming on steroids now. And so just communicating how we're going to move forward, that I don't see us as law enforcement. We are a corrections organization, and we've done things in support of that, such as changing language. We don't refer to anyone as an inmate or an offender. They are residents. They are part of the larger community. And so these are people that just have had some challenges. And so we're here to help them get back on track. But we are not the police. So we're not going to behave like the police. And so that was a bit of a shift in thinking for some of my staff. A lot have embraced the change, the name change. The House of Correction to the Community Reintegration Center. And for me, it's more than a name change. Our behavior has to align with who we say we are. The name change is aligned with our mission and vision. And so we want to make clear why we exist, you know. And so sometimes for tenured employees, change can be difficult. In terms of our residents, I think that they are getting more opportunities than they have historically gotten. We are intentional about staying connected to our community partner, so there's a smooth transition back into the community as we reintegrate people. We want people to be successful. We don't want to see that revolving door of people coming in and out. This job is not easy. A lot of people look at it and may think it's easy, but we are the gravity of the work. We are responsible for lives. Not only staff staying safe, but keeping our residents safe who come in with a number of challenges. When I say we, jails, prisons are the largest de facto mental health hospitals. So we are seeing people with that come in with significant mental health challenges that are higher risk than historically we've had to deal with. So that's a shift for us.
So a phrase you just used really stuck out, that jails and prisons are the largest de facto mental health hospitals in the state. Can you say more about that?
Sometimes when people misbehave or engage in certain behaviors, oftentimes due to their mental health conditions, sometimes there isn't anywhere to put them but jail. And so we end up with a population that we weren't necessarily equipped or trained to deal with. So we brought in additional training for our staff. Like I said, the crisis intervention training. We have a special dorm for individuals who have a hard time functioning in general population because of a mental health condition. And so they get a little more attention in our facility from the mental health practitioners, and we have specific programming to help them do better.
So I want to end on another open-ended question. Genuinely not looking for a right or wrong answer. This is me wanting to get inside your head, see how you think about this. Why do you think people commit crimes?
Oftentimes I feel like it is due to lack, sometimes out of necessity and sometimes out of opportunity. But a lot of the individuals that we see, I think a large percentage, and I don't have the numbers, have some type of substance use disorder or was using at the time of the crime or right before. And oftentimes that drives some of the behaviors that we see. And that's why we feel that it's important to treat it. Or if someone can't find a job, that doesn't mean they stop living or don't exist. They figure out how to get their needs met, and it's not always legal.
Well, Superintendent Jewell, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect. I appreciate your time.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Chantel Jewell is the superintendent of the Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center. She spoke with Lake Effect's Sam Woods. Precious Lives was a series about gun violence and youth in the Milwaukee area created by 371 Productions that aired on WUWM. In 2016, a Precious Lives story featured Garland Hampton, a man serving a life sentence for a crime he committed as a teenager. Hampton was released on April 14, 2020, and in 2023, he joined me to share his story of redemption, advocacy, and economic empowerment in his life post-prison.
In my journey of me being incarcerated from prison to out here, there came a point in time when I was incarcerated where I was faced with a decision to make. Either you grow old or you make the necessary changes that you need to make to be a better person. You know, growing old, you don't change. You stay the way you were when you came in. Growing up, you evolve, you elevate. You learn things, you arm yourself with certain tools that you believe will help you be successful out here in society upon release. So that opportunity for me, I took full advantage of it. I knew what I had to do for me because I was all I had. And I knew at that point I had to be in my own best interest. So I decided to grow up as opposed to just growing old in prison.
How are you feeling after leaving prison and having to essentially start over as an adult in a place you hadn't been a part of? I imagine it's not an easy transition because you went to prison at 15. How did you feel making that transition initially?
I was a little scared. But what made me scared was me feeling vulnerable. I felt like the world was going to swallow me up. Here I am. I'm fresh. I'm new. I don't know about none of this stuff that's going on. But more so, what was scary for me was I left this world as a kid. That's a completely different outlook on what life is. So for me, it was like everything was brand new. The people that loved and cared for me when I was a kid, they had all passed away while I was incarcerated. You know, so in my mind, it wasn't, what am I going to do? It was, now was the time. This is what you prayed for. This is what you dreamed for. This is your moment. This is the opportunity that's here for you. Now you have to seize it. So I hit the ground running. The first thing I had to do, I said, I got to get employed. I had many jobs through temp services. Some places turned me down because I was out of prison, on parole, and the main thing was you don't have a work history. Others were like, well, if we hire you, people finding out that you are a convicted felon, you're on parole, you went to prison for murder, how do you think that's going to sit with them? You know, so it was all these hurdles, but I knew that this is what I was going to be faced with before I even came out here. With me constantly selling myself and presenting myself in a way in which I know I could be used to help whatever company or whatever business grow, somebody's going to take a chance. I just have to find that somebody who's willing to take that chance. I went to a place called Big Step, WRTP. They help guys coming out of prison with landing a job, chasing their dreams of a career, getting driver license, getting CDL license, whatever you need, they're helping. I went to them, landed a job in construction, and boom, and here I am, a pile driver. Been working for my construction company ever since. Those guys have been, or have, and still is, amazing. They helped me along the way. They continue to help me. And, you know, it was never a thing of you being discriminated against because you're out on parole. None of that. It was, you know, okay, you're part of the family now. You're part of this brotherhood. Whatever we can help you with, we're going to help you. So it's been a blessing. I began to say to myself, you know what, I got a life now. I was starting to feel, you know, like I was living and I had built something for myself. And that was all I wanted, was that opportunity to make a life for myself.
Outside of the job and finding a stable job and the hurdles you face doing that to gain financial stability, another thing you've worked hard to do is own your own home. And you've worked with some local banks to secure grants on revitalizing Black communities, in addition to being a homeowner yourself. So can you share a bit more about this process? You talk about the difficulties you face finding a job. Did you face those same kind of things trying to show banks, like, I am a good candidate to be a homeowner?
Oh, wow. Now, that was one time in which I dropped my head. I had went to several banks, was turned down. I couldn't even open up an account. So I ended up getting a checking account and a savings account with U.S. Bank through the Department of Corrections. Because the Department of Corrections, U.S. Bank, handle all of the financial accounts for prisoners in the state of Wisconsin. So even then, it was rough for me. They said, well, you're no longer in the Department of Corrections, sir. You can't open up an account with it. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. You have my money, my release account, my savings account. You know, you have my money in your bank already. I'm already established with you all. Well, no, sir, you're not established with the Department of Corrections are. So here I am, released from prison, calling back to the prison, telling them to call U.S. Bank to vouch for me. Well, once you was released, you're out of our custody, you know, you're on your own now. Wow. So then I had a hard time with getting the little money that I had saved up for myself from working prison jobs while I was in prison. So I go to my parole agent. We wrestle with the banks and so on and so forth. And then we finally get to break. U.S. Bank just turned the little money that I did have. They said, okay, they took the Department of Correction name off the account and put my name on. So now here is my first start. Now I want to buy a home. can't get a loan from U.S. Bank, can't get a loan from BMO Harris. Nobody would take a chance on that. So I was sitting at home one day, and I told my fiance, I said, you know what? One day I'm going to buy us a house. I said, it's not going to go like this forever. So she laughed at me. I said, you laughing, but I'm serious. And shortly after, she was on her phone, and she said, baby, they have this open house. Let's go check it out. And I'm like, I'm not going to that, no. She like, come on, you never know. So I said, okay, I'm going to go. I met a lady there by the name of Miss McCloud. And she just welcoming me in like this. It's like, this don't happen. She did a soft pull. She's like, you know what? You qualify. I said, qualify for what? She said, our program. So she went on to explain to me about Chase giving you the $5,000 loan grant and so on and so forth for you to possibly get your own home on. And we go on with the process. And she said, congratulations. She shook my hand. And at that point, I was like, wow, it was one of the best experiences ever of my life. So I went through the whole process. Not only did I qualify for that through Chase Bank, there was another program through the city of Milwaukee, the first-time homeowner program. And so my fiance, she said, so you still wanted to stay at home, huh? Didn't want to come. And I looked at her and I smiled. She said, I told you. She said, look, you never know if you don't try. And I was like, yeah, you're right. You know, I never thought that I would be able to come home and, you know, accomplish the things that I have accomplished, being that I was in prison.
You are working on building sustainable wealth for yourself and your family. That's one tool you're using to build your life post-prison. And in the Precious Lives episode you were featured on, it ended with how you share your story with dreams of working with young people in Milwaukee if you were ever released to hopefully reach the people who might be suffering the same way that you did. Can you share how you're doing that today and what kind of conversations you've had with others so far?
Well, first, I had to be willing to accept my past. And so with me coming in grips with all of that, at this point, I'm ready to help somebody else because now I know how they feel, I know what they're going through, and I can relate. So what I do now is I work alongside a organization here in the city of Milwaukee called 414 Life. They are a violent interruption group of guys or organization that, you know, try and mediate or hash out situations before it gets bad, you know, to where one end up in jail, lose their life, fight or whatever, you know, just peace, bring down the crime rate in our city, and help those who are in need of help, in particular our youth of today. And I talk to a lot of kids, and I let them know that, look, at any given moment, with the snap of a finger, you can make a decision or a choice that changes your life for the worse, forever. And I share my story with them. I let them know, hey, look, I've been there. Homeless, poor, abused, raped, physically beaten, mentally beaten, spiritually beaten, in prison as a kid. I've been through it all. I've been there. And a lot of kids feel that they don't have nobody they can talk to. Kids these days have the responsibility of an adult, but as a kid. And so they are being robbed and deprived of life before their life has even began. And that's where I was at. And I was forced to survive in an environment in which I knew nothing about. I had to learn these things. And I try to be a resource to present that to these juveniles that's out here who feel like there's nobody listening to me. Where do I go? There is that opportunity for you. You have to go get it. But how can I go get something if it was never presented to me? How can I go get it if I don't know what's there? Then once I get there, tell me how this works. I need you to take me by the hand and show me. So I try and be there for them. You know, it's about giving back. This is my way of giving back, you know. And I said that at one point in time, I was part of the problem with the destruction in some of these neighborhoods in this city. You know, even though I was just a kid, you know, if I help mess it up, I just want the chance and opportunity to help clean it up.
Well, Garland, I want to thank you so much for continuing to share your story. I'm honored that we got a chance to follow up with you, you know, since 2016 and learn about what's happened since then. And I wish you nothing but the best.
Thank you. And I really do appreciate it. This means a lot to me. And like I said, you know, from the cradle to the grave, you know, this is my mission. This is what I would do up until the day God called me.
Garland Hampton was featured in episode 100 of the series Precious Lives. When we spoke in 2023, he was working in Milwaukee with the organization 414 Life. You can find more information and listen to the original Precious Lives episode he was in at WUWM.com. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen on demand. In about 10 minutes, we're heading to Mamie's on Milwaukee's South Side to learn about the city's best dive bars. But first, we'll go to Kinship Cafe, where young women teamed up with local chefs to try their hand at cooking. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Last month, the organization Pearls for Teen Girls invited students and chefs to collaborate. It was a way to introduce tween and teen girls to the art of cooking and to connect the community with Pearls. Here's how people who attended described it.
Phenomenal.
Delightful.
Amazing.
Pearlific.
Ooh. Stupendous.
WUWM's Mayan Silver takes us to the event. Cheers to Pearls Who Cook.
A platter of spinach artichoke crostinis have just come out of the oven. Shania Hutchins, the cafe manager of Kinship Cafe, and 12-year-old Zuri Green are about to spoon hot pink dollops of beet-infused pickled onions on top. That garnish is Zuri's influence.
Yes, pink is my favorite color. My room is pink. I love pink. It's just, it makes me happy seeing pink.
Zuri is a member of Pearls for Teen Girls, a nonprofit that provides mentorship and opportunities to middle and high school girls. That includes one-on-one coaching, college and career readiness, and peer and intergenerational support. The organization also hosts events like this one that pair girls with professionals in a particular career. Tonight's focus is culinary arts.
So my dad cooks for the family, and I grew up like watching him and him teaching me how to season food and how to cook dishes and stuff. So I got inspiration from my dad.
Zuri and Chef Hutchins are prepping their appetizers at the Kinship Cafe in Bronzeville's spectacular Thrive on Collaboration building, also called Thrive on King. It's in the renovated Gimbel Schuster's department store that was open on King Drive from the early 1900s to about 1970, and it's a vibe. Green and Hutchins carry out the crostini to feed people who've arrived, like Mike Bartel.
Well, let me try this. This feels lovely. A moment of truth. So shall I be like Guy Fieri and tell you all the things that I like, or Bobby Flay?
It's very hot though.
Bartel bites into the crostini.
Excellent crunch. Cheese stands out, and the hint of the pickle is perfect.
Thank you.
Girls, please raise your hands.
Caitlin Cullen is welcoming people in. She's been instrumental in setting up the event, since she's both on the board of Pearls for Teen Girls and is the director of the food center that now runs the Kinship Cafe.
You might know about Kinship, but you might not know that much about Pearls. You might know about Pearls, but you might not know much about the Thrive on King. And truly, you might not know these chefs yet, right?
Cullen says both Pearls and Kinship share a core value, fostering community.
It's hard out here to be alone. And as we're looking at the future that we keep walking into day after day, it's terrifying to look two steps forward and not know who's going to walk with you. And I think Kinship and Pearls share that very much. So it's about walking together.
Colin knows a lot of chefs in Milwaukee. She used to run The Tandem, a restaurant in Lindsay Heights. She helped pull together this crew of chefs that are mentoring the girls. In addition to Shania Hutchins of Kinship Cafe, there's Tamira White of Delicious Bites, which opened about 2 years ago on 66th and North, Josh Mendiola of Sanford, and Michaela Erickson and Joe Sutter, who plan to open a restaurant called Radish in Bayview. Erickson and Sutter are mentoring two Pearls sisters, 9-year-old Christy A and 14-year-old Soraya Culpepper. Well, how does it feel to be in the kitchen?
It feels good.
It feels very fun.
What's fun about it?
I like to learn how to cook stuff and learn new things that I can cook.
Erickson says the four sat down together the week before to get a sense of what food inspires the sisters.
She loves sushi. Her favorite thing is a shrimp roll. She wanted a dumpling soup, so we kind of did a hybrid and did a shrimp dumpling with some sushi familiar flavors, the ginger and the soy. So
their next goal was to celebrate Wisconsin winter produce. Erickson says even though it's limited, you can make it exciting.
So we have some cabbage as well as parsnips for a little sweetness. And then all the welcomed flavors, ginger, garlic, some fish sauce and soy sauce. And then on top of that, we have a shiitake sauce that is in the kitchen. I'm going to have to run and grab. And then some really nice green herbs, scallion, cilantro, toasted sesame, and serrano. That's a mouthful.
At that moment, Joe brings the shiitake sauce out.
He's got it. He knew.
It smells really nice.
I was describing the dish and realized we didn't have the sauce.
She says the girl's enthusiasm reminds her of herself when she was that age.
Both of them, I overheard them talking in the kitchen, and I heard them say that they wanted to be chefs. So, I mean, I think hopefully we're steering them in the right direction.
Their parents, Chris Culpepper and Aisha Barbie, are super proud. Did you try the dumplings?
Oh, yeah, they are really good, really good. They did a great job.
Jalapenos have a lot of kick to it.
Yes, they do.
Their grandfather, Darren Alford, is there to support, too.
I love this more than you know. Our grandbabies, my heart is just so happy right now. It's so happy.
Alford is wearing a green sweatshirt with the Milwaukee Bucks logo, decorating it dozens of times.
Question for you though, are you happier than when the Bucks won the championship?
Yes, big time.
Josh Mendiola of Sanford Restaurant and his Pearls co-chef Ava have made a Filipino version of chicken soup.
In this version, it's a ginger chicken meatball, a lemongrass and ginger broth with chicken fat cooked chayote and pickled green papaya.
And a lot of herbs.
And for the sweet tooths in the bunch, or really those that just like a little dessert, Tamira White and Pearls girl Trinity Harris have you covered.
So what we did was I made a strawberry bun cake. We have a red velvet bun cake with a caramel drizzle. And then we have assorted cheesecake jars. Those are huge in the store. So we have a Biscoff, an Oreo, and a peach cobbler.
Trinity says it's felt good to be paired on this.
I learned that you need like a lot of patience with cooking, and like you need to like make sure you're like focused with cooking. Yeah.
Trinity's dad, Jamel Harris, says any opportunity to give kids mentorship and exposure to new skills is important.
I want every kid to experience events like this, not just my kid. One of the things my family does is we want opportunities for all children in our community. Part of the reason why we fight the way we do in our community is to give every kid an opportunity to experience nights and events like this so we can hopefully inspire them to be better people tomorrow.
And if that involves a little bit of Biscoff cheesecake, chicken meatballs, winter dumplings, and spinach artichoke crostini, all the better. Mayan Silver, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Pearls for Teen Girls is a local organization that fosters opportunities and mentorship for young women. The organization is a financial contributor to WUWM. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, and when we return, we'll explore what makes a dive bar such a staple in Wisconsin culture. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM.
Us two ain't nothing here.
This is Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Dive bars are as much a part of Milwaukee culture as beer and pull tabs. In fact, Milwaukee Magazine featured some of the city's best dives last year. That's when Lake Effect's Joy Powers met up with MilMag's executive editor Chris Drosner at one of the bars that they featured, Mamie's. Over its more than 40 years in business, Mamie's has become an institution in Silver City on Milwaukee's south side, serving a diverse clientele and offering up some top-notch dive bar amenities like pool, dice, and even a working payphone.
The term dive bar is a bit divisive. How did you go about figuring out what a dive bar was for this article?
Yeah, it is very subjective. And you know, especially with Debbie, we were sensitive to, you know, that one connotation of dive. And we did what we always do with stories like this. We kind of took a celebratory tone. But yeah, I mean, like, there's a lot that goes into it. For the bars that we actually featured, the photography was really important for us. We wanted them to look great. So the visuals inside the bar were really important first. And then, you know, is it a good bar? Is it a place that we would, like, feel good sending people to? Because that's not always the case with every dive, right? And then there was the question of, well, can we really make a case that this is a dive? And that wasn't really the case with a lot of bars that we considered. And maybe, I mean, you could make an argument that, like, maybe Stella's, which is one of the bars that we featured, isn't truly a dive, even though it's right there in its own name. It's like Stella's, the cocktail dive. But, you know, we did this little piece of the package is signs that you're in a dive and signs that you're not. And frankly, one of them is there a cocktail menu? And Stella's has a cocktail menu. You know, I mean, we kind of broke our own rules a little bit, but it's dive bars. It's supposed to be fun, right?
Yeah, it's fun. So with that in mind, what are some of the signs that you're in what you'd call a dive bar?
This is probably the most fun piece of the whole thing that I had putting together, because, like, the research for this was like going to bars and just thinking about where you're at and what makes it what it is and kind of deconstructing the dive bar experience. And that, like, it's a different way to think about bars than the way that you usually are thinking when you're in a bar. So yeah, this was fun. I mean, most of these are like signs of, like, maybe like lower quality bars, or definitely like the family kind of aspect, which kind of came through in a couple of the profiles. But like, someone lives upstairs is one of the things. Like, these are in neighborhoods and people live here. You know, crock pots. Like, you know, these are places where people are really comfortable with each other, and they'll bring in, you know, like snacks, or, you know, like meatballs for game day or whatever it might be. You know, Just Arts down in Walker's Point is one, and I think they do kind of a sketchy-ish kind of like crockpot buffet on certain days and stuff like that. So
when you say sketchy-ish, you mean like it's a potluck that anybody who comes to the bar is
kitchen.
Okay.
Yeah. Totally. You know, like funny signs. Like, there was this one place in West Dallas that we went to that ended up on the list but not as featured, and it's got a sign on the exterior door that says, "Use doorknob, please," which raises a lot of follow-up questions. But
who wasn't using the
door?
Yeah,
you get in otherwise, right?
What was happening that the sign had to be put there to say, please use the doorknob?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. A lot of it has to do with, like, choice or lack of choice. You know, kind of the activities that are happening. Bar dice is one of them. There's a CD jukebox, you know, that, I mean, there's one here at Mamie's. You know, kind of these throwback things that are being kind of pushed out of these newer places that, in many cases, are replacing legitimate dives.
Mamie's even has a payphone.
Oh my God, is there? I wish I had noticed that. Oh my God.
Under the barber pole.
Under the barber pole.
That's where to find it. So with that in mind, we just pointed out there's a payphone in here. There is also a jukebox, as you mentioned. They have bar dice. What are some of the other attributes that landed Mamie's on the dive bar list?
Well, one of the things that really hooked us on this one, which I had heard about Mamie's for a long time before actually coming here, and one of the things I had heard was that it's super friendly. Everybody's very welcoming. This is a bar on 33rd and National, so you know, near South Side. It's very welcoming. It's very diverse. And when I say diverse, I mean people of all walks of life, people of all ages, people of different ethnic backgrounds. So, you know, it's a very unusual bar in Milwaukee, which, you know, we kind of just socially, I think people kind of tend to cluster into their little groups and their little cliques, and that is not really happening here. Everybody is just together, and when you're here, oh my God, what is that? I was just about to say some kind of advertising slogan. When you're here, your family. What is the Olive Garden?
Yeah.
But you really
do. It's the Olive Garden of dive bars.
You really do feel welcome. And actually, I felt that in all the bars that we ended up featuring, which I think I went to all of them.
I've been to a lot of the bars that you feature. What are some of the different bars that are featured in this?
We had a really tough time picking these. I mean, there's so many to choose from in Milwaukee. And really, like I said, the kind of the deciding factor in a lot of these ended up being how they look. I mentioned Just Arts. That's one of them. It's the loquacious owner and bartender there, Art. JMO's over on the east side is another one, which has been one of my favorite bars since I discovered it a few years ago. The light in there is just, it feels like exactly how I want my bar lit. Low, soft, colored, beautiful. It's great, just a great bar. And good vibes too. Dale's, which is up on 61st and Capitol, or 62nd and Capitol maybe, which is, you know, primarily African-American, but it has this, like, it was founded by this guy, Dale, who was a clown. Like, that was kind of what he did outside of the bar business. And so there is a ton of clown stuff. It's just one of those, like, super weird, like, everything's, like, what is this? So, and the soup is great, too. So it's super interesting mix of kind of culture and again, super friendly. And all this clown memorabilia, really? Like, what's the deal there?
Very interesting.
So we also included Stella's, which I mentioned, downtown, in this kind of weird part of downtown where there's not really a lot of other places. It's like by the library and Barrett Center. So it's kind of in this little backwater, but really cool, kind of cocktail oriented, definitely a newer type of dive, but good vibes there. Only two beers on tap, which I feel like that was like a feather in its cap as far as like whether it's a dive or not. And then of course Mamie's here on the south side. Oh, and Gordy's. I almost forgot about Gordy's, which is just this quintessential neighborhood bar in a little neighborhood in St. Francis. Feels like it could be in any small town in Wisconsin.
Very nice. So I did a call out to see which shots were very Wisconsin or Milwaukee. And there were two main contenders. One was a blackberry liqueur. It's like a Polish liqueur.
Polish blackberry brandy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a blackberry brandy or Rumpelmann's.
Rumpelmann's, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. What do you think is kind of a quintessential Milwaukee shot?
I mean, I'm going with whiskey chased by a PBR or a High Life. You know, the Boilermaker? I mean, I think that's probably it for me. Anything nasty. I mean, I'll get
anything
down with
nasty. Malort
or Fernet or...
You're getting down with Malort. I don't know about your choices.
No Malort? No Malort for Joey?
Look, I've had Malort. We've all had Malort.
Have we?
Well... Many of us have had Malort. If you've ever accidentally sprayed perfume in your mouth, you've had Malort.
I mean, that's just rude to Malort, but probably true.
It's rude to the perfume, to be fair.
But, you know, like, that's, to me, I want to know I'm drinking a shot. Give it a little burn.
Fair enough. All right. I'm going to see if the lovely Michelle will come over and explain bar dice and play dice with us.
Chris Drosner is the executive editor of Milwaukee Magazine, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in October about their features on Milwaukee's dive bars. At WUWM.com, you can hear Joy, Chris, and Lake Effect's Sam Woods learning how to play dice with Mamie's bartender, Michelle Belling. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at the importance of news literacy in a time of prolific misinformation. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.